Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this September 28. We talk about education the first hour of our program today. The president's been talking a great deal about education. Today he's going to be giving his back-to-school address. That will be at 12:30 today at a school, high-performing school, high school in Washington, D.C. Last week, he had some things to say about No Child Left Behind, and that will be the focus of our conversation, the first hour of our show today. Hour number two, we have a rip-roaring good program today. Ron Suskind will be joining us, author of The Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. He has a lot to say about the major figures in the administration, the financial collapse, Elizabeth Warren, his advisors, criticism that the president has been too close to Wall Street. He takes the president through the campaign as well and remembers some of the comments he made about reforming the financial system then and compares it to now. It's a very good book, and we will be talking to Ron, hour number two. Hour number one, Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. You'll recall that last week the president said that he wanted to reform No Child Left Behind, and that the changes that he would like to have would minimize the need for educators to teach to the test. His rollback comes in the form of a waiver package. States that seek relief from the provisions of No Child Left Behind, including the 100% proficiency requirement in reading and math by 2014, increasingly harsh sanctions against schools deemed as failing, or the strictly dictated use of federal education money, will have to adapt certain administration-mandated reforms. Those reforms include college and career-ready standards, targeted intervention in low-performing schools, and new teacher and principal evaluations that include student test score data. That's the controversial part, one of the controversial parts of the reform. Wisconsin is going to be asking for a waiver package, and we will talk about all of that this hour of the program. And welcome your phone calls. We have a number of people who are vitally interested in education issues in our audience, and we'll welcome your thoughts about this. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Steve Correa, thank you very much for being with us again.
Oh, very glad to be here. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It seems to me that the controversial part of what the president had to say is teacher and principal evaluations that do include student test score data. So if we're trying to get away from teach to the test, does this reform do that or not?
Well, I think, you know, as in just about everything, like when you buy the car, do you want the rust proofing? And when you get this, what does that mean? What do teacher evaluations mean?
Right.
So I think as a lot of this is, it's sort of still very slogan-oriented. And exactly what shape it's going to look in all 50 states and the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, we're not quite sure. So certainly there will have to be aspects, so that will have to be factored in. But, you know, with the race to the top money, a lot of states made that adjustments with statutes so that teacher accountability based on student test scores is really already factored in. So it's like that particular battle has already been fought. So in a way, the Obama administration is presenting something that's a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so now what it means in terms of, geez, is it test scores? Is it some other kind of variety of assessments, portfolio assessments, qualitative, quantitative interviews, growth? You know, this is just a whole menu of options. And I think the reason that some states are finding this appealing is the exact same reason some people are very opposed to this, because theoretically we could definitely have 51 very different teacher accountability systems. And so exactly, you know, how this is going to be factored in is, wow, what does this mean? But for now, it appears to be a very powerful sort of statement, but in reality, it may not really cause much change at all.
And we got No Child Left Behind through a bipartisan effort in Congress. There has been criticism of the president for doing this by executive order.
Yeah, you know, it's really sort of fascinating. And I think the politics of federal government role in education is in itself, of course, an entire area of study. But most people listening might recall where President Bush was on 9/11. As he was reading to an elementary school class, he was touting his No Child Left Behind initiative. And then, of course, the entire world changed on 9/11, especially as those words were whispered in the president's ear. And we all sort of forgot about that. But the federal government role in education significantly goes back to President Johnson. And it was part of that war on poverty. And so it's always been seen pretty much as a bipartisan coalition of forces that all want to be able to help provide equal educational opportunity. Its real name is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, started back in 1965. And since then, it's had some just phenomenal names. I'm sure there are many marketing classes around the United States that study the names of these. It's a cottage industry coming up with names for these. We have under the Reagan administration, of course, it was a nation at risk. And then we had Bush's No Child Left Behind, and now we have Race to the Top. I think where they dropped the ball was back in 94. It was the Improving America's School Act. But they've all had these names. Now, we've also had then the title programs that some people listening might be familiar with, for example, Title IX. Which is about gender equity in schools and especially regarding sports, but in other areas too. And these are all of the federal programs that dollars are given to states, and then they funnel through states to local school districts. So we really have about almost a 50-year direct federal role in education. Now, what we're talking about today is these are authorized by Congress. Money is authorized by Congress. Theoretically, the executive branch can't do that. Well, President Obama has been waiting for Congress to deal with the reauthorization of ESEA. It's supposed to have been reauthorized in 2007.
Oh, my.
Think about where you were in 2007. Now, President Truman, he had a nice label for his Congress that he didn't like. He called him the Do-Nothing Congress. And it's always easier to get elected when you can find an enemy. And what Obama has been hoping is that there would be action on this. But, you know, politically, boy, neither side wants the other side to look like they won and look like they lost. And so politically or constitutionally, this is really a super gray area. Can a department rewrite a federal law? This is absent hearings. This is absent legislation. Now, legally, this continues on unless Congress decides to change. And the Obama administration has decided that the Department of Education, on their own, this is called unilateral action, has decided to rewrite this. Now, it may be a good idea. You might like it. You might not. But I think Congress was kind of like, ooh, wait a minute. What are we going to do here? There's a constitutional issue. How do I soundbite that? Do I like these? And, of course, no politician wants to be seen as being soft on education.
Right.
You've got to be an advocate. Now, it depends what side of the coin you come down on. Now, in Wisconsin, of course, recently, it's become very popular to be hard on teachers and supportive on education. So, you know, this is an interesting area, but the Obama administration is out in front. They've said we're going to make changes, and we can go over those in a little bit. And now people are saying, ooh, you know, politicians, gee, do I want to bring up this little legal issue, or do I want to jump on board with what these policies are, or do I want to parse out these policies and talk about what I like and what I don't like? And so, you know, it's an interesting little potentially sticky wicket that some of these places are trying to deal with.
As you well know, Professor Correa, a lot of the conversation concerning education, at least in the state of Wisconsin and other places, has to do with voucher schools, with charter schools, with finding alternatives to public education. What does the change to No Child Left Behind have to say about charter schools, about voucher schools? And the second part of the question is, why does that seem to be the focus of conversation rather than looking at where the vast majority of our children are educated, which is public schools?
And that's really a great question. I think some of the attention given to charter schools, which will decouple from vouchers for a second, is that charter schools are seen, probably rightly so, as being very creative and imaginative and really doing things that haven't been done and zeroing in on very specific needs. And clearly there's evidence that charter schools have done that. There's some just phenomenal charter schools, whether it's at risk or whether it's project-based learning or, you know, the whole variety of those. The downside of charter schools is not really charter schools themselves, but part of the promise of charter schools was that they were supposed to then help inform changes in the more traditional setting. And that linkage, that communication, just hasn't happened. Nobody's quite sure how to be able to get, how to translate the changes in the charters to the public. So it's not exactly an unfulfilled promise, but it's an unfulfilled potential that hasn't really been addressed. So that's one. But charter schools are nice because they're kind of bright and shiny, and they do some good things, and so we like them. Now, vouchers are a very different animal. That is the distribution of public money to, theoretically, public and or private education. And that is supposed to be the idea of encouraging competition and market forces into the delivery of education for students. And that one, boy, you know, that the evidence for effectiveness for all of these schools, again, it's like quoting the Bible or your brother-in-law. You can find good things and bad things. You can find support or not support. There's some evidence of effectiveness. There's some evidence of questioning. I think any empirical researcher would say, you know, to mix our metaphors, the jury's out. We just don't know. But you can cherry pick your evidence if you want to. There's some good. There's some question. But people are flocking to these because education has become a very convenient area for politicians to be able to gain some traction. And politically now, education, it's on its heels, and it's backtracking. Now, you can blame who you want to. In my conversations with local teachers that I work with, lots of people do every day, they're really unhappy with whether it's WEAC or NEA or AFT, saying that they got caught flat-footed. And, you know, they should have been out in front. But be that as it may, education's a target. And so charters and vouchers provide a convenient vehicle to be able to say, not only are they bad, here's the way to be able to propagate change in the future. And so the changes brought about, or the current proposed waivers, they do nothing to stop the growth of charter schools, and that's probably a good thing. The other side of this, they do nothing to dissuade state-based education, which we still have in the United States, to be able to encourage those systems because they're still looking for innovation and a lot of other things that are changes within public schools. So those can continue unabated. And so that's why charters and vouchers are very, very attractive. But they're very, very different sort of changes moving forward, especially with funding.
And I know with No Child Left Behind, low-performing schools in this country had to show that they were making yearly progress, or those schools could be closed, they could turn into charter schools, the principals could be fired, the teachers could be fired. do the president's comments about No Child Left Behind change the way we deal with low-performing schools or not?
That is just an excellent, excellent question. And the truth of the matter is, yes, and it does in a way that most people, if you're really reading this, you know, you really have to look at this carefully. Now, it does provide for its initial provision of the waiver that low-performing schools, and by low, I mean low-performing schools, will still be subject to the exact same sanctions, meaning that the schools could be dismantled, you know, teachers could be dismissed, a whole variety of, you know, really serious sort of sanctions and penalties. However, mediocre-performing schools, which previously easily could be labeled failing if they didn't meet these proficiency targets, they are off the hook. And so while we're still going after the really bad schools, and that's a positive thing, like I say, the mediocre schools who maybe don't address the needs of, you know, reading across all groups or math skills or something, no, these waivers do not really address them, because they're allowing states to be able to set the bars for appropriate academic performance. And then subsequently the measures, although that's a slight different one with Common Core standards, but they're allowing the states to be able to determine when these are appropriate. So, and the Heritage Foundation, which politically, of course, touts its conservative credentials, is saying, hey, wait a minute. This is allowing low-performing schools out, but what about that, you know, second bottom quartile or quintile? They're all of a sudden, you know, their accountability shifts from federal accountability to state accountability, and is that really what we want? So the light will shine a little less brightly on mediocre schools. And again, the Obama administration has decided that we're going to target really poor performing schools and put our attention there and put attention on teacher assessment and test scores and some other aspects. But schools that, like I say, aren't really, really, really bad, they're sort of off the hook here. So, yeah, you know, it's not good in terms of accountability equally for everybody.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. And we're trying to be specific about, well, there are a lot of things on the table here, but we wanted to look at the president's comments last week, reforms to the federal No Child Left Behind Act, which he believed would minimize the need for educators to teach to the test. States would be allowed to seek waivers around key provisions in the law. There is some question about whether or not teaching the test would become less important as a result of these changes. And we're welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, Ron Suskind, will be our guest. His book, you probably know about it. It's received a lot of attention. Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He also wrote The Way of the World, The 1% Doctrine, The Price of Loyalty, and A Hope in the Unseen. Let's go to phone calls now for Professor Steve Correa, starting with Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Kathleen. You know, after listening to the professor describe the bureaucratic rearranging of the deck chairs and our educational complex here in the United States, I just wanted to connect some dots and then hear what he says about this. Yesterday, which shows that while we sit here and kind of congratulate ourselves as we rearrange these deck chairs, the world around us is absolutely knocking the hell out of us educationally. Witness the fact that yesterday, Cisco announces that they're going to be putting one, and you always ask, Kathleen, where are the jobs? Cisco says that yesterday they're going to put $1 billion into creating a new Silicon Valley in Russia, okay? And then they're going to invest $100 million in venture capital. And yesterday, the head of the jobs, Umo, announces that they're putting together a multi-hundred-million-dollar complex in India, manufacturing complex in India. So while we sit here and rearrange the deck chairs in this disaster, educational disaster that we're sitting on and thinking with, you see what's going on around us, headed by U.S. corporations. They don't bother with this stuff. They just go and do what they need to do to get the necessary educational talent. I'd be interested to see what your professor guest there thinks about that reality.
Thanks, Andy.
Well, Andy shouldn't sugarcoat things so much. I think that there are some issues out there that we have to deal with. He has some, obviously he has some very selective examples there. What I might start out with saying first, which one might expect from me, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. No country in the world tries to do with education what we do in the United States. And the evidence is clear. We have more high school graduates than we've ever had. We have more people going to college than we've ever had in our history. We have more people reading at higher levels than ever. By lots and lots of measures, schools are doing things at a higher level than has ever been done before in history. So the question may not be the effectiveness of what we're doing now. The question may be, which is I really think what Andy might be talking about, is do we really want to be doing all of the things that we are doing now? And that is a completely different question. Schools spend more money on food for students and nutrition than they actually do on the delivering of instruction. So schools take on a whole variety of combination of things. Now, the examples that Andy shared, I'm not familiar with specifically, but I know that, across the world, when you're looking at growing populations, education has become this idea of a very convenient way to be able to segregate differences between schools and cultures. Now, whether it's Russia, now I know of very few people that would say the Russian education system is superior to the United States. Maybe back in the 1920s, some Columbia University professors would have said that. But there are examples of things and initiatives that companies find attractive. I would argue, though, that they're there because costs might be lower. They think they're going to have easier access. They're going to wake up and find out that those things actually aren't going to happen. So I would say that now, whether or not we want to have education doing the things we do, that is a completely separate question. And that is, I think, a very viable and realistic debate to be able to have. But American education takes on more challenges, everything from food to busing to transportation to education, and every child attempts to be a part of that. Teachers have become convenient targets, whereas anyone that's ever worked within positive change in an organization knows that you have to have buy-in and support and empowerment of professionals to bring about positive changes. Strong districts have teachers that are involved and central to the change process, just like strong hospitals have medical staff that are involved in decision-making and processes. It makes no difference. So the selective examples of whether it's Cisco or whatever, they're good examples, but, we can't predict what we're going to need 15, 20 years in the future. So education tries to focus on these kind of basic skills. There's no challenging the fact that there are many groups that are not performing at high levels in schools, but the evidence is also clear that we are doing more than has ever been done before. And when you compare apples to apples, the American education system is still the best in the world. And the education system in Wisconsin is absolutely phenomenal.
Thanks, Andy, for the call. It seems to me that the students we are not helping, and this has been so for years and years and years, that you could probably safely say that we do have an educational disaster when it comes to educating minority students in urban areas in this country. The dropout rate is so much higher. The test scores are what disparity there is. There are problems, significant problems in this area, I think.
And that is absolutely correct. And you are right. And Andy is too. I'm by no means, you know, dismissing his overall concerns with that. When you look, though, we still continue to have this American dream ideal that education can solve issues like that. And it really, again, we even widen the field more of what we think education can do. And when you have, as for example, you know, the poverty rate in Wisconsin, look at the rate that went up.
Yes.
I mean, we're over 15%. When you look at those kind of economic forces and we look at the menu of support options available for those people that find themselves on the outside looking in, we don't have many. So we look at schools for food, we look at schools for social support, we look at schools for emotional development. Oh yeah, we better teach them to read. So we still look at those. And one of the problems with looking, for example, at reading scores or math scores in high school sophomores is the students that are being tested in the United States, they are theoretically everybody, and by the way, that's a positive thing about No Child Left Behind. Everybody gets tested. When we're comparing our scores with England, for example, by 10th grade, those students have been separated into college prep and college track and advanced track, and students that are going to go into more vocational technical eds, and those students aren't part of those test scores. So we're not really comparing apples to apples. But your insightful observation about what we're not doing well, that is absolutely correct. And I think that to expect schools on their own to continue to do this is just a complete silly idea. And we have to have politicians that have the gumption to be able to look at the whole choices that we give. We're cutting public health programs. We're cutting support networks. We're cutting public transportation on and on. And yet we still are expecting those students from those schools that are from those regions that are marginalized and those groups that don't speak English, and we're cutting federal funding to be able to compete. It's not going to happen. And so we do need leadership from politicians that can do that. And so far, boy, there have been very little of that. Those are loud voices, but they're far outside the mainstream to be able to bring about those changes.
Paul in West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Kathleen and guest. Glad your guest just answered my one concern that your previous caller had raised, and that was that not all of the students in all of the other countries are tested. And I come from this from a background of 38 years teaching in Wisconsin public schools. And for the last 2 years, I've been doing professional development for a National Science Foundation-funded science program in four Midwestern states. I've worked in Chicago public schools and Indianapolis public schools. And I guess my question to your guest is, what is the role of professional development in terms of putting out quality teachers once they've been hired in the classroom? Some districts do a great job with this, as I've seen. Indianapolis Public Schools is doing a phenomenal job of trying to train all of their teachers in the elementary schools. Susan Becker, the director of science curriculum down there, is doing a fabulous job working with teachers to bring everybody up to speed with a lot of the changes that are taking place. And a lot of this has to do with, as I've seen it, competent, invested administrators.
And stay with us, because I want to hear more from you, Paul. Professor Correa.
Well, yeah, Paul's involved. If he's involved with the National Science Foundation, we're talking gold standard with quality teacher development and quality programming. So, you know, they're the ones that a lot look at for the organization and delivery of effective teacher development. So kudos to him many times. The specific question, though, that he asks is, and I know that Paul knows the answer to this, but it's a great discussion topic, is how do we develop teachers to be able to seen to be understood as a profession that has steps of development? Now, one of the problems with the waivers in No Child Left Behind is it mandates test scores measure teacher effectiveness. Now, again, the extent of that we don't know. But it totally dismisses other teachers working with other teachers. It totally dismisses or allows, you know, doesn't build in peer evaluation, peer discussions, the ideas of steps within the processes, maybe beginning teachers, the idea that, you know, you need to develop more skills, you observe these built-in development steps that might have teachers helping each other to develop, and then the entire profession is lifted up. Anybody knows that teaches, and I believe Paul indicated that he taught for 38 years.
Yes.
He has to have a sense of humor to have lasted that long. Wonderful for him. But the idea is, what you do in your 38th year, theoretically, a teacher does in their first year. And anybody knows that's not possible. Teachers need to develop, and research shows, increasingly effective menus of options to deal with the variety of students that they have. So teachers need to develop throughout their profession. And all professions do that with ongoing development, and really good school districts and good principal leadership. That's what the National Association of Secondary School Principals, they've been really a part of this, trying to build in these programs that are both in-house and without, that help teachers to be able to have goals, work towards those goals, work for multiple measures, peer observation, peer discussion, peer measurements, peer ongoing. And this is not, it is lifelong goal-oriented, and you have metrics along the way, but a single metric of a student performance on the WKCE or whatever, oh my gosh, that's like telling a patient they're healthy because their cholesterol is low and you miss everything else in their body. Mm-hmm. It's maybe
a... Well, that's an interesting way to put it. Paul, if we've done one show, we've done a dozen on a shortage of science and math teachers. Can you talk for a moment about the number of people who should be entering this field? We obviously need really bright, dedicated science teachers. Have you noticed that they are hard to come by, and what can we do to address that?
Well, I think, Kathleen, what you're seeing is there's a reluctance on a part of a lot of people to go into the teaching profession because of all of the problems that they're seeing nowadays.
Yes.
There are very bright individuals that are applying to get into to teaching science, but they don't tend to last. They get frustrated by some of the issues that they're up against in terms of trying to develop their own professional status. And they're also frustrated by, quite frankly, a lot of the anger toward teachers. You know, if they're going to work 60 to 70 hours a week, which most of them that are doing a really good job, and that's the majority of teachers are, they can do a lot better working in the private sector and be compensated for a comparable position significantly better.
This is something we have to change, it seems to me, in order to make education better. This whole, this targeting teachers is really troublesome, because where would any of us be if it weren't for our teachers? They're just so important. And for them to be demoralized is just not a very good thing.
That's correct. I did have to appreciate your guest comment about maintaining a sense of humor. You do that over the course, long course of your career. But you have to look at it as a position that's going to be a career if you're going to stay with it and really ultimately maintain that sense of humor. Is a lot of studies have shown, you know, the current generations are looking at having, you know, 8, 10, 12 jobs in their lifetime. That's not productive to be a good teacher. You know, as your guest said, you develop your professional expertise over the long course of your career. At age 50, I went through National Board Certification, a tremendous growth process that I would recommend to any teachers out there listening, taking a look at yourself and reflecting on what you do and why you do it and improving how you do it. And so, you know, you've got to look at this as a long-term kind of a career, which, you know, things like Teach for America, while good as they are, kind of indicate to the person, well, this is something I'm going to go do until I find something else better to move on to. And that doesn't really move the teaching profession forward. It may help in some certain spot instances, and you may get a few really outstanding young teachers out of it. But in the long haul, it really doesn't move the profession forward that you'd like to see.
Thank you, Paul. I'm so glad you were listening. Will you address this matter? Because we keep referring to it during the course of this conversation of teachers not getting enough respect. What do we do with that? How do we change that, Professor Correa?
Well, I think that, you know, part of it is, you know, this an economist talks about incentives. And fear is a very limiting incentive. And right now, as a profession, the teaching profession, for those people that are in it, it's very fearful. And they're finding themselves on their defensive. They're finding themselves having to justify things that in the past, it's, you know, these teachers are very committed emotionally. And, you know, they're wanting, or people are requesting, really simple answers to really complex issues. And frankly, you know, it's like that old joke about, you know, the beatings will continue until the morale improves. And that's almost what we're talking about here. Whereas any field, and you look at good school districts, and I live in the city of Appleton, and my children go to the Appleton area school districts, and Appleton, much to their credit, decided to continue and extend the teacher contract with the local collective bargaining unit for 1 year, just simply to gain some breathing space and to be able to say, what's going on? Let's see if we can get the lay of the land. We have a good district, we have positive relations, and we want that to continue. And so, you know, districts have to be able to pause and to be able to say, how can we continue this healthy relationship? Now, unfortunately, this is back to political science. Sounds like a big social studies class, doesn't it?
it's an everything kind of class today.
It is, yeah. The idea, though, is this divide and separate politics. Okay, we have economic troubles. Illegal aliens are the problem. Now we have our divide and conquer. Education is an issue. Teachers are to blame. Okay, we have our divide and conquer. Labor isn't working well. People are losing jobs. Oh, it's the workers' problem where we've divided and separated. Here's the problem. And the problem, the issue with that is, it hardly takes an effective look at solutions. It provides nice little quick sound bites, and somebody can perhaps build a platform about it. But the reality of coming up with solutions instead of divide and conquer and moving forward and visionary issues to address it, it's not there. Yet, we know, organizational behavior people know, you have buy-in, you have respect, you have professional organizations that come in. These systems are in place, and they can be replicated. But you don't do it by deciding who the bad guy is, labeling them, coming up with a narrow interpretation, and then saying, okay, I solved that one, and moving on. It doesn't work, and it leads us to this current situation. And so, yeah, it takes reflective people that are able to say, let me think about this. And that's, I hope, why people listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. Let me think about this.
I like that. That's a good slogan for us. Let me think about this. Thank you for that. Paul, thanks for the call. We'll take more of them in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Steve Correa, and we are thinking about education this hour of the program, with the president having a speech last Friday, actually, seeking some changes to No Child Left Behind. And we're concentrating on perhaps the most contentious part of that among teachers, which is teaching to the test. But there are other provisions here. So why the president decided to do this and how we improve education in the United States, of course, behind all of our conversation. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program today, Ron Suskind will be with us. His book has received a lot of attention, Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. He's been with us talking about his other books. This one is substantial, and he's a heck of a writer. So we will talk with him about all kinds of things, particularly, of course, focusing on the relationship between the administration and Wall Street and the changing nature of that relationship and why that is so. Jeff is our next caller from Dressbach, Michigan. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, hello. Am I on?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, yeah. I'm actually from Minnesota.
Oh, Minnesota. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I have a number of disagreements with the guest, but I think he's very much in the effective domain, and I think that people who have my teaching background in science and math are very much in the domain of content. And I would point out that, well, my wife also has been a teacher for many years. She can't teach multiplication to people who haven't learned to add. We can give a test that finds out if people have learned to add. So teaching to that test is exactly what you want to do. And if people are unable to teach people how to add, then they should be fired. What do you think of that idea?
If that's directed to me, I think that that's a good idea. I don't think anybody would exactly challenge that. And certainly, and I'm sure the caller is probably familiar with, common core standards have become now very, very popular. And I believe, and perhaps even the caller might know more about this than I do, I think there are 44 states that have signed on to the Common Core Standards. And those standards are very skills-based. They are really involve reading, writing, and math. They're almost like, you know, the old three R's. The appeal with that is that they're trying to come up with a common language, common vocabulary, and hopefully, theoretically, common assessments to be able to set a floor for these basic skills. And so I don't think anybody would say that those basic skills are not important. The idea is, though, those are floors, and we go someplace from there. So certainly the caller is absolutely correct. We have to be able to have those basic skills. And so, yeah, those are supporting. Those are supportive. And so, you know, there's hardly anything controversial about having students clearly learn their basic math skills. Supportive of that.
Well, can I make another comment?
All right, Jeff.
I think that the problem of disrespect for teachers has so much to do with the fact that so many teachers don't know what they're there for. I've witnessed it for 28 years. I've taught high school, tech school, and I've been 20 years at a university. And I can tell you that teachers, you know, are increasingly those in science and math, my colleagues, were in terrible trouble with student evaluations, which were given at the peak of student frustration right before finals. However, we all know if you talk to people in this world, they will say, I remember old so-and-so that I had for this course, and I hated that SOB at the time, but by God, he taught me more than anybody else that I ever had. And had that person been given a student evaluation at the peak of their frustration, they probably would have collectively managed to get that teacher fired. That's what's wrong today. The expectations are unclear, possibly, probably, because the teachers don't know what they're teaching towards. Because every teacher has this agenda that's it must have been invented by Marshall McLuhan's label idea that, you know, if we talk about it enough, we think we learned it. We need to make it clear what needs to be learned by having the test first, then the content develops, then the method, then we have learning. And when we stop having testing that's appropriate, which is what everybody's fighting these days, we stop having learning. You had just the other day a guest from Iran was on talking about foreign students' troubles in the United States. This gentleman said, if he entered classes here and knew more math and science than anybody and coasted right on through, went on to graduate school, noticed that all the graduate school students were foreign students. Why was that? Because they have rigorous testing, rigorous teaching, rigorous education. They do not dwell in the namby-pamby domain, the effective domain of everybody happy, everybody I'm okay, you're okay. It doesn't work.
Yeah, but don't you have to get your students interested in learning? If I were in school testing, being tested all the time, I'd think, what a drag this is.
Well, that's what the problem is. Today, the students all think that it should be TV. It should all be, you
not
know,
TV, not TV.
Giant robots.
No. But interesting material rather than taking a test all the time.
Oh, no. The interesting material is fine, but you have to know what you're teaching and why you're teaching it. And people today are just, I've seen the evolution of teaching. I've seen the good teachers drop out. I've seen the head bobbing, everybody's okay teachers predominate, including your guest. That's what's wrong.
Professor Correa.
Okay, well, what I would agree with the caller with very much is that schools that do their job well and help students to learn and grow into citizens are schools that teachers do know what they're supposed to do. So the caller is exactly correct. It's curricular cohesion. It is an understanding of assessment. It is this idea that we all have to be on the same page, work together. And then also what the caller's talking about is we have measures of student learning that are understood. Now, I think where I differ with the caller is the definition or what we mean by learning. And I do take a wider view of learning. I don't just look at learning behaviorally, meaning it's a specific skill set and an ability to do specific things, whether it's quantitative or whatever the case it might be. We have cognitive, we have humanistic, we have emotional, we have a whole variety of those. Now, that's another discussion, but schools do take on those wide variety of learning challenges, and they try to help students to develop holistically. Now, but he is exactly correct. There are a lot of schools out there and a lot of teachers that aren't quite sure what they're supposed to do. And so teachers sometimes are looking. So principals need to know what's going on. They need to be in those classrooms. Teachers need to be able to get the feedback. And he's also exactly correct. There's nothing wrong with teaching to the test if it's a really good test. But that test does not mean fill in the bubble. It could be a variety of assessments. Where I would take exception is I think that I have, with the teachers that I've worked with, that I'm not part of the problem, that I'm working to be able to help teachers to be effectively and to work with teachers to be able to understand their profession and to approach students holistically and not solely on a skill-based manner. That's sort of a different discussion than we'd have time to go in here, but teachers do have a lot that are presented to them, and it's not solely computational or a specific skill set. It's a whole way to be able to look at, because that's a human being coming into your room, and we try to be able to help them to be able to grow into productive adults. But he's an intelligent man, so there's no, you know, this is a good person.
Thank you, Jeff, for the call. Let's try to do one email and one more call. We're running out of time. Pat in Wausau, hi.
Yeah, I'm not quite there with your guest. I just take a little bit of offense to the divide and conquer rhetoric. And I just want to find out, you know, give us some statements, you know, from elected officials, from public officials, about targeting teachers. I mean, I haven't heard any, and I guess, you know, if he's from up in Appleton, he's probably been aware of the situation at Kaukauna, where they've, in many school districts, where they've saved a ton of money on, you know, different health plans.
Professor Correa.
Okay, well, he's from Wausau, so he's got three, you know, just exceptional schools right there, East and West, and then Cardinal Newman. So it is, examples of this is, and the previous caller would be an example, that we are targeting perceived deficiencies in teachers, and the idea is almost always, here's the evidence that they're not doing what they're doing. They're not teaching to read. They're not teaching to write. We have a high dropout rate. We have this achievement gap, and the idea is teachers are held accountable. I would say, have you ever heard one politician say, we have a dropout rate, oh, by the way, we also have a poverty rate, and we have these cuts in social services. Now, we know that this is a community problem, a county problem, a state problem, a regional problem. No, the sentence never goes on. We identify a deficiency, and then teachers are identified with that. Now, in Kaukauna, since the caller brought that one up.
About 30 seconds left.
Kaukauna has a variety of problems. They did save some money with their health plan, but you know, Kaukauna is trying to build teacher cohesiveness, and they have a ways to go with that.
Thank you very much. We these conversations are always all-encompassing, aren't they? You can't talk about education without talking about life.
No, it all fits together.
Yeah. It does. Thank you. Thanks for being with us.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
Professor Steve Correa, Associate Professor of Teacher Education at St. Norbert College. Our conversation, the prompting of the conversation from the president making comments and an executive order to change some of the provisions of No Child Left Behind, which education has been living with in this country for quite some time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. I'm sorry we didn't have time for all of your calls or emails, but we'll talk about education again. Please stay tuned. Ron Suskind is coming up next hour, and we're going to have a whale of a good hour. Thanks for listening to this one.